Welcome, I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Your Call. A 2012 study published in the American Journal of Public Health linked racism to poor health. Researchers concluded that, quote, repeated exposure to moderate racial discrimination can cause illness after a while. And also that, quote, early childhood may be a crucial sensitive period when stressors such as racial discrimination affect a person's long-term well-being, since these stressors affect how the young brain develops and forms neural connections between different regions. So today we're talking about how racism and prejudice affect young people and how adults can prepare children with the tools they'll need to either avoid, cope with, or even transform incidents of stereotyping or bigotry in their lives. And from the outside world, popular culture and media have strong influence on kids. So what's the popular culture kids are consuming most? How are African Americans, Asian Americans, and Latinos being portrayed in those narratives? What kinds of stereotypes are operating in new media and old media in 2013? And how can parents, teachers, and other adults help young people of color find their own critical perspective on the media that they consume? Today with us is Melanie Killen. She is professor of human development, professor of psychology, and the associate director for the Center of Children, Relationships, and Culture at the University of Maryland. She's author of many studies, many books, among them Children and Social Exclusion, Morality, Prejudice, and Group Identity. She's published over 130 empirical journal articles and book chapters, and her book on morality in everyday life won the Outstanding Book Award from the American Educational Research Association. Last year, she was commissioned by Anderson Cooper to conduct a study on children's racial bias for a set of stories that aired on CNN's AC360 called Kids on Race, The Hidden Picture. And Professor Killen joins us from her office in Maryland. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And with us also is Chris Johnson. He's a photographic and video artist. He's a writer, curator, and arts administrator. In 1996, he created this innovative one-hour video piece titled Question Bridge that investigates class divisions within the Black community. The current version of this project, Question Bridge Black Males, was produced with Hank Willis Thomas and appeared simultaneously at the Brooklyn and Oakland Museums and also opened at the Sundance Film Festival last year. Chris Johnson is currently a professor of photography at the California College of the Arts, and he joins me in studio. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for being here. Milton Reynolds is also in our studio today. He's senior program associate with Facing History and Ourselves. Before joining Facing History, he spent over 10 years as a middle school teacher, a diversity communications consultant, and as a curriculum design specialist, and has over 25 years of counseling experience. Milton has a strong interest in understanding how the legacies of our collective history manifest themselves today, and specifically how the past informs our actions and decision-making processes today. Milton has been a youth counselor, a middle school teacher, a service learning coordinator, a tour guide, a stand-up comedian, and a research associate at UC Berkeley. And more recently at Stanford at the Center for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity. Everyone very well qualified to talk about our topic today. So, Melanie, let me start with you, kind of with the academics and the studies. You're a developmental psychologist. You've studied the interaction that children have with race and identity. And like we said earlier, Anderson Cooper did an extensive report on kids and race, and he commissioned you to kind of look into that. And it was based on a study from the 1940s called the Doll Study. Doll, D-O-L-L. So can you introduce us to basically what that was and then how your research followed up on that?
Right. Well, the classic doll
Hello,
studies
Melanie?
That were conducted. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead. Yes, I can hear you.
You
go
can
ahead.
Hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. The classic doll studies were conducted in the 1940s with children, and they showed a black doll and a white doll to children, African-American children, both in the South and North. And they found that African-American children would prefer the white doll to the black doll. And this sort of set in motion a set of interpretations about this in terms of how is this affecting their self-esteem and their sort of own understanding of their identity when they prefer to have a white doll over a black doll. And this research has been was profound, had a lot to do with the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision about desegregation in the schools. So it was very important in its time. However, what we've learned over the decades is that it's a much more complex picture, so that to some extent, while self-esteem might have been important, we also now know that a lot of it also had to do with status, that these children understood that a white doll had higher status than a black doll. And so we've come to look at that in a different way, a much more complex way. What we did with for Anderson Cooper is that we used a measure we've developed before, and we interviewed 145 kids in a range of different schools that varied by the ethnic makeup, some that were all white, some that are all black, some that were mixed ethnicity, including other different ethnic groups as well. And we gave them a short task in which we showed them a picture of one child standing behind a swing, another child in front of the swing, and we asked them what happened. And it's an ambiguous picture because you could say one child pushed the other child down, or the child who fell down is going to get up. And what we did is we had two versions of this picture that were absolutely identical except for race. So in one picture, the child standing behind the swing is black and the child who fell down is white. And then we reversed it and we had the child standing behind the swing was white and the child who fell down is black. And we asked children, what happened here? Can they be friends? Would their parents want them to be friends? And just to sort of simplify it, the main finding we got is that children who were white children, for example, who were in white schools, would attribute negative intentions when they saw the child standing behind the swing who was black, and say, well, he pushed her off, or he pushed him off. Whereas if they saw somebody who was white, who was like them, what we call in-group member, standing behind the swing, a white child, they say, oh, he's going to help him up, or she's going to help him up, her up. So the idea is that this is a measure that assesses what we call implicit bias. So there isn't an explicit use of a stereotype. It's an implicit bias because children are pretty much unaware that they have this bias, that they're attributing negative intentions based solely on race.
How do they form these implicit biases? How and when do they form these implicit biases?
It's an excellent question. It's what a lot of us are doing research on. They form them very early. I mean, there's actually research in infancy that looks at when infants prefer a race that looks like a face that looks like their own skin or another person's skin color. Whether that's related to prejudice or not, we're not sure. But certainly our study was with six to nine-year-olds in a study we did, and also with Anderson Cooper. And so these biases come in early. And how do they form them? A lot of it is through associations that they have in the media, as you mentioned earlier, the images that they see all around them, whether it's video, games, or movies, or TV. And we talked a lot about the role of parents and what parents can do to address these biases. And we do talk a lot about what white majority parents can do, as well as what ethnic minority parents can do. So a lot of our messages are about how do we as a society deal with these kinds of biases that are forming so early.
Right, and you have another test where you show children a series of cards with visual scenarios. One was two teenage girls, one dark-skinned one, and one light-skinned one. One is standing off to the side, one is leaning down, about to pick up a dollar bill off the floor. And you ask the students, you know, what's happening here? And it seemed when the darker-skinned girl was the one leaning over the money, they thought she was going to steal it. And when the races were flipped, they thought the lighter-skinned girl was picking up the money to return it. So
right,
does this kind of reflect the same implicit bias that you were talking about?
Yes. I mean, we had a number of different scenarios, or what we call picture cards. We had one where somebody could be pushing someone off a swing, one where somebody could be taking some money. And we had a version for young children, so it's around the playground. We had a version for adolescents where it was in a school hallway. So it's the same content, you know, you're taking money from somebody in the playground or in the high school. But yes, that's the same kind of thing with adolescents as well. We also got these kind of biases. But here's a very important part of the findings that we have. And that is that if we're taking the majority group, the white kids, for example, in our studies, there's a big effect for whether they have and report cross-race friendships and whether they're in schools that are ethnically diverse. So our main finding is with white kids who are in all-white schools and don't report any cross-race friendships. But white kids who are in diverse schools that are diverse by ethnicity and report friendships, they do not display this bias. So, in fact, our students and our kids who are in ethnically diverse schools reporting friendships don't display this bias. It's really a very much of a product of them being in very homogeneous schools. So that's an important part of this finding, which means that their social experience and who they become friends with and their opportunity for friendships is having a big impact on how early they are, you know, displaying and revealing these biases.
What really surprised you in your research? In the report, you say it's been shown that race is one piece of information that children use to form expectations about others' intentions. You know, someone listening might say that's pretty obvious, it's not surprising. What in your research really surprised you, though, about the findings, you know, with kids talking about how they perceive race? Was there anything really unexpected?
Yes. Well, first of all, it was unexpected that these young kids would, you know, attribute negative intentions solely based on race because they're interacting with kids all the time. What surprised us was their responses to the role of parents. So that when we asked them, well, would the parents want these two kids to be friends? We found that in particular, the white kids, again, in the white schools were much more likely to say that, no, they wouldn't want them to be friends. And sometimes that's when we got explicit stereotypes. Well, because they look different or because the other person doesn't look like us, or because we don't share interests, or they don't share interests. So that's actually triggered some explicit stereotypes. Whereas kids who are in, again, these ethnically diverse schools and talking about friendships had very different responses. You know, the parents would want them to be friends. They want them to have someone to play with. You know, they would just take it as if it was a same race dyad, as you know, in contrast to an interracial dyad.
Right. So it seems like it's not only coming from the media or the schools. Mom and dad have something to say about who their kids associate with and play with as well. This is, we're talking to Melanie Killen, professor of human development and psychology in Maryland. And let's go to our studio guests. Milton Reynolds from Facing History, Facing Ourselves. Does any of this, you know, surprise you? You've been working in this field for a long time.
No, I mean, none of this surprises me. It, in many ways, it confirms what certainly as an educator I observe in schools and certainly is resonant with my own experience of growing up. I mean, what I would add in there that there's also a series of experiences that people have on a daily basis that give us, that inform us about race and our own identity. And so the question is, you know, how do young people navigate these issues, particularly navigate these issues in the absence of conversation? Now, I think there are different patterns of conversation. You know, if you look at different groups have different levels of conversation about race. But I think, you know, thinking about this in terms of education, one of the challenges, I think, even though I support efforts to desegregate, is that when you take young people, particularly young children of color, and you put them into an environment, particularly if they're not in the majority, and they're having racialized experiences, yet in many cases the norms may be non-conversations about race. So this idea of being colorblind, that there's something about talking about race is inherently racist. And so for a young child trying to navigate a series of experiences that very much are racial, or maybe other identity-related experiences, but we're talking about race today, and then if they're in an environment in which the non-conversation is the norm, then it's very hard to figure out those environments. Those environments then become, in some cases, sort of laden with threats. And so what's interesting to think about is how do we help young people, and maybe perhaps more accurately help adults prepare them to be better able to have those sort of conversations and conversations that are rooted in a deeper understanding than their own individual experiences. Because I think another thing about race is we tend to think about our own experience is universal to everybody else, and why we may have some experiences that are connected by virtue of being members of some identity group, we also are having individual experiences within the context of that. So, you know, a lot of issues on the table. But again, a lot of this sounds very, very familiar.
And you like to focus on the history as well in your work. You have this approach where you know, you don't know who you are until you really reach back and read your history and understand the history.
Yeah, I think, you know, Facing History's work is really about confronting history. And we our work is structured by a series of themes that I think are useful to think about in the context of this conversation. Is we deal with issues of the individual and society or issues of identity and the power of labels. We deal with issues of we, they, or how does one find membership in community? How do groups form their sense of identity? We look at the power of case studies. The case study that I think is most relevant to this conversation is one titled Race and Membership in American History, the Eugenics Movement. So we look at the scientific reification of race through four primary areas of influence, looking at immigration policy, looking at education policy, looking at the history of marriage restriction, but also looking at the history of sterilization in this country. Out of that, we look at issues of justice and judgment. And lastly, we try to look at this idea of choosing to participate, which is an intentional effort to move conversations, historical conversations, away from ones that are sometimes too simplistically framed as perpetrators and victims to include the role of bystanders or upstanders. And so I think when you're talking about these issues, having a language and a structure that invites people in the conversation is important. But I also think the grist for the mill is important. And briefly, I think looking at the history of race as an idea is something that's legally and politically constructed is really, really important. It is a central organizing principle of most modern societies. So the idea that you can simply move away from something that's so foundational is somewhat absurd. And so it raises questions. I was in an exchange with Chris a little bit earlier. You know, who controls the narrative? You know, who curates these images that people are forced to respond to? And I think it's fair to suggest that at least at this point in time, people of color are not, in the driver's seat primarily in terms of curating these images about people of color.
Okay, Chris Johnson, why don't you weigh in? Who does create the narratives? Because I know many people who would say, well, you turn on the TV, you turn on the radio, and, you know, there's a lot of people of color. There's, the hip-hop movement. And so what is really going on? Who is creating the narrative, and what's wrong with it?
Well, I think we've heard a real clear explanation of what's wrong with it. I mean, we all feel pretty much overwhelmed by the negative messages that are coming from all directions. And narratives are obviously created at many, many different levels. I mean, every person who wakes up in the morning creates a narrative about who they are, who they think they are. And then they are embedded in a family that embodies a narrative about what it means to belong to a small community. Then they go out to school and either do or don't get get those positive or negative symbols reinforced. So, you know, we're awash with narratives. And I think one thing that that Milton said is really important is that, you know, these narratives are curated in a way. They have intentions behind them. And one of the things that's really a problem with our culture is that there really isn't a lot of analysis and deconstruction of the way those messages are created. I mean, that's called media literacy. I mean, in other English-speaking countries, media literacy is a required subject, whereas here it's kind of subversive to talk to people about what the symbols mean, what the intentions are behind the persuasions that are directed at young people. And that kind of understanding of the way the media culture shapes individual identity and warps individual identity when it's put to bad intentions is something that all of us really need. Because unfortunately, a lot of the studies, the scholarship that we've been talking about so far, goes over the heads of children and parents who really are the activators of this process that we're talking about. So, I mean, as an artist, I come at this not as a scholar, but as an artist, as an image maker. And so trying to take responsibility for the role that we have as image makers in creating alternatives to these narratives. I mean, that's why Question Bridge was originally created, as a way to, as an artist, create a new opportunity for people to explore self-expression, and then for people who witnessed the project to come away with a different experience of, in this case, African-American men. That's one of the core intentions of Question Bridge, to change the way people understand the nature of black male identity. That's why it exists the way that it does, the Question Bridge Project.
Melanie Killen, can you tell me, Chris was just talking about some of the research, you know, goes over people's heads, and how do you take your research, how do you take your studies and turn them into, you know, easy to follow recommendations, and what would those recommendations be to the families and to the kids?
Right. Well, we've done this a lot, very extensively. I mean, I've given a number of, you know, town hall meetings in school districts on issues of diversity in childhood. And so we have social policy reports. So, I mean, I'm very much in line with the notion of translating research into practice and into educational policy. One of the big messages that we have for parents, I think, will confirm what both the other speakers were talking about, is the fact that we know that ethnic minority parents prepare their kids for the world of discrimination. I mean, they have to, they do it in many different ways, but that's coming in early. And what happens, though, unfortunately, is that white majority parents don't tend to do this. And why not? Because they do tend to sort of often subscribe to a colorblind theory. Rebecca Bigler at University of Texas has shown this over and over. And so what we're trying to do is to tell, and we ask parents, well, you know, why? And she asked them, and we've done this in our research as well. And their response is, well, I don't want to introduce the notion of race because then I create the problem. And so what we're trying to tell them in the message is, you're not introducing it by talking to your child about it because they already have it. It's already there. We've got, you know, we can demonstrate these implicit biases that come in early, and then follow up with some explicit statements that they'll make about whether parents would want two kids of different races to be friends. So it's obviously there. So we talk a lot about, because I think that's very important, you know, the role of white majority parents in terms of this whole issue. We talk to them about the fact that, you know, if they're at the park and they see one child hit another child, they're going to go over and say something like, well, you shouldn't hit them, and why, and, you know, if somebody hurts you, how do you feel, and so forth. We talk about empathy, perspective taking. Well, we need to do that when there's an act of racial exclusion or prejudice or discrimination. You know, we can't not talk about it, and a lot of parents think that that's what they should do. In fact, again, you know, we hear over and over reports of, you know, white parents saying, well, you know, my three-year-old, you know, they're in the gym at the locker room at the YMCA. My three-year-old sees somebody different skin color, and they say, you know, why did they have brown skin? And, you know, the white parents often have this approach of sort of hush-hush, feeling embarrassed about it, wanting to wait till they get home. And we sort of say to them, you need to talk about this as you would anything else, in a very confident and direct manner, and not to act as if it's a taboo subject. So that's a whole, there's a whole set of kind of messages and recommendations that come out of how we can all deal with this and start to change the narratives that people are talking about. And I think that's fundamental and very important to do it. The point I wanted to make in response to what one of the other speakers said is about the desegregation issue, and that is that we find over and over again that cross-race friendships are significantly related to reducing prejudice. So this is fundamental and important, and parents, all parents, need to be doing this, need to figure out all the ways that they can of encouraging kids by either as a role model, but also just by when they set up play dates, all right, those things that happen early.
Okay.
And so the role of friendship is very important as well.
Thank you so much. Melanie Killen, professor of human development and psychology at the University of Maryland. I know you have to go. Thank you so much for joining us today, Melanie.
Thank you.
programming here on KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Al Sedaris, we'll visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com. To take part in today's Your Call conversation, please call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you're a first-time caller, let us know. We'd love to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, a conversation with Rodessa Jones, performer and activist Rodessa Jones. Friday is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. But today, how should adults prepare children for racism and prejudice in society? We're talking about how kids are facing a prejudiced world, how to talk to them about coping with racism. If you're a parent, educator, someone who works with the youth, how do you help them? How do you help the children around you confront discrimination? Give us a call. You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you'd rather email us, you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or a third way is to leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Joining me to discuss this issue are Chris Johnson, artist, photographer, and founder of the Question Bridge series, Question Bridge Black Males. We did a piece on that for Cross Currents on KALW last year.
I remember that.
Yeah, we did.
Thank you very much. It
was excellent. And also with me in studio is Milton Reynolds. He's an associate, program associate at Facing History, Facing Ourselves. And now joining us on the phone is Shakti Butler. Shakti has decades of experience as a catalyst for racial equity. She is multiracial, African-American, African, Arawak Indian, and Russian Jewish, whose work as a creative and visionary bridge builder has challenged and inspired learning for over two decades. She uses film and dialogue. She's the producer and director of groundbreaking World Trust documentaries like The Way Home, Women Talk About Race in America, Mirrors of Privilege, Making Whiteness Visible, and the most recent, Cracking the Codes, the System of Racial Inequity. Dr. Butler is also founder and creative director of World Trust, a nonprofit based in Oakland. Thank you, Shakti, for joining us. Hello, Shakti. Are you here? Maybe she will join us in a little bit. So, Chris and Milton, let's go back to our conversation. How do you use research like that of Melanie's, Melanie Killen? We spoke to her earlier in the show, and there's all this research out there and all these numbers and all, you know, how do you use that? How do you kind of break that down and really use it in schools, you know, in homes, in communities?
Sure. Well, I mean, as an artist, what we use are our experiences and experiences that we have with other people. And so and those experiences embody a lot of the consequences of the research that you've been talking about. And so, as you know, Question Bridge is really, as I said, an attempt to try to create an alternative to the normal way that people relate to each other. And so Question Bridge starts with the assumption that if you can create a safe setting to give children, in this example, a chance to frame a question, a hard question that they have. I mean, because all of us walk around with hard questions, questions that are at the center of our lives. If you can create a safe enough setting for people to express those questions, then they're more likely to listen to an answer. Because the problem of listening is what the breakdown in conversation, the problem of listening is the thing that creates a lot of the problems that we're talking about. So what Question Bridge does is first solicit these questions from people.
Like what?
Oh, well, like, for example, there was a young man in Algiers, Louisiana, who we encountered in this project. And all we did was just encounter him at a church, invite him to our studio in the Ninth Ward. We had no idea what he was going to bring to the conversation. He sat in front of our cameras. We got the lights all set up. And his question was, I try to live good, but I'm surrounded by bad. And I want to know what I can do to live better and live peaceful when I'm surrounded by all evil. How do I do that? So,
and who answers the questions?
Well, that's the thing about the way the question bridge process works, because that question really energized the process of us going around the country. We spent 4 years presenting the questions that we gathered from people of all walks of life and ages and sexual orientations. And then we play those questions for people who are likely to offer answers. And so what you see when you experience question bridge black males is these poignant questions and then answers. Many, many different answers. And so some of the answers, of course, have to do with empowerment at an individual level. We get young people to respond to him who said, you know, try to join other groups that are positive. We got people who said, just the fact that you're asking that question shows that you have an awareness that can lead you out of this problem. There are people who offered religion as a solution. So a witness of the Question Bridge Project gets to see the question and then a wide different array of answers. And that, what that, one of the things that that range of answers does is breaks down the monolithic notion that people have of the way black men, in this case, feel about the various issues.
With us now is Shakti Butler. Hi, Shakti.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And we have a number of people on the lines. If you'd like to join this conversation, please give us a call, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. How do you deal with children and race? How do you speak to children about race? What do you see around you in your communities? Shakti, you've just joined us, but I really want to kind of jump into boys and girls. You've studied women in terms of racism. You've studied the effects on women, and I'm wondering. I have two girls, and can't see me on the radio, but I am of color. So, you know, I feel like girls and boys experience racism in a very different way, because for the girls, the issue of beauty and appearance and the hair, you know, there's all of that. Whereas those issues might not be, you know, prominent in a boy's experience. So I'm wondering what kind of work you've done in the realm of women, young ladies, and girls in dealing with, you know, stereotypes and racial prejudice?
Mm-hmm. Well, the work that we do is for young women and young men and older women and older men, for both genders and other classifications of gender. I would say that in this specific instance, what you're speaking about is colorism, and that there is a great legacy of how color plays out in communities of color. And so that the lighter you are, you have certain value ascribed to you, and the darker you are, you may have some very different values ascribed to you. But I'd like to really talk about how we frame the conversation on race.
Okay.
And why it's important for parents to understand the frame and for young people to be invited into leadership and developed as leaders who can address the complex problems of today's world. So I think we have to understand race as a system. And a system, just like the human system, is very complex. It has lots of parts that are working together at the same time. And when part of the system breaks down, the job of the body in this case is to repair itself. So it is with the system of, and I'm going to use to coin John Powell's word, racialization as a noun, meaning it's a process that's ongoing, different from prejudice, but including prejudice. We have to understand the system and provide a frame that allows a complex conversation to happen. So the system of racialization is embedded in history, which informs culture and identity. It's moved by power and economics. It has internal components, which are bias or implicit bias, privilege and internalized racism, and it has external components that play out in relationships that are interpersonal, institutional, and structural. Structural meaning the network of institutions that work together, consciously or not, to perpetuate the status quo. So the system keeps reforming itself, and we see it play out in young people's lives, hence the response to the testing that your first guest referred to, and understanding how history is a part of this, and how black men in particular, and again I'll say the darker black men are, the more they will have certain traits ascribed to them. So if we don't start looking at the complexity of it and preparing young people to be able to analyze as well as deal with historical wounding, then we can't really make headway here.
Wow, that's a lot for a child to absorb and to understand and to use.
Right.
You know, we haven't figured it out. You know, we adults are still dealing with these issues on a daily basis, and I don't know. We're asking our children to kind of deal with this world. I don't know. It sounds again just like whew over the top of the head. Let's take some callers if that's okay. I'm sorry, Shakti. Yes. Let's take some callers. We have some callers that have been waiting patiently. Thank you. And the number is again 866-798-8255. We'll go to Kara in Oakland. Hi, Kara. Thanks for waiting. Kara, are you there? Kara is not there. Okay, let's go to Karen. Karen in Berkeley. Hi, Karen. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for having this. I think this is really important. So what I'm calling about is I just recently saw a photograph of the Jackson Five from 1969, 1970, and each one of him and his brothers had a perfect afro. Today, if you look at the BAMMYs or the Grammys or the magazine covers at the supermarkets, or you watch TV, you go to the concerts, almost every black woman has straightened blonde hair. These are icons. These are image makers. So if you're having a very confusing projection, one of your guests was talking that he was in entertainment, and he's talking about image. And so that image that's on records and on TV and everything is showing African-American women that are icons, that are important, they're successful, and they all have straightened blonde hair. Etta James, Nicki Minaj, Beyonce, you name it, you can just go down the list. So that's a very confusing image if you want children to think about racism and think about the differences of the races and how they're supposed to deal with it. To me, as a parent, I find this really contradictory. And that's just a comment that I wanted to make, and I'm glad you brought up the hair image, because that's, the whole thing is all about hair. It's all about hair. Yeah.
Okay. A lot of it is. Thank you, Karen, for the call. Shakti, where is the line drawn between what Karen just said in terms of black women, entertainers, influential figures, you know, wearing their hair blonde and straight? But, you know, someone else might say, hey, that's my personal preference. That's what I feel like doing. I don't mean to be, you know, mimicking white women. You know, it's a tough line to walk. How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you using the word line, which I think we all do. We look at good, bad, right, wrong. And yes, it's complex. We have individual choice. But our individual choices are not just because we're individuals. They are informed by history and culture and identity. And so we make choices. We have the right to make choices, but there are collective patterns that are coming from somewhere else. I wanted to say that the way that we deal with the complexity of this, and I think that the frame that I gave you is really for parents, mm-hmm. is we do it through film. Mm-hmm. And film makes things very accessible so that you can break down examples and use story to really understand how it is that we're walking through the world the way that we do, particularly as it relates to race and all other forms of oppression. So this difference between our individual choice and our collective impact is something that has to be considered from lots of different perspectives. And I think when we deal with asking good questions, when we allow young people to bring in their own lived experience and that they're well-informed by their parents who are well-informed, then you have the opportunity to both make individual choice and to also consider where those pool of choices are coming from.
Hmm. Milton, I want to go to you, Milton Reynolds, of Facing History, Facing Ourselves. I'm wondering, either Milton or Chris, if we could do a little role play, you know, there's like specific scenarios and how a child should would respond, or, you know, should respond, if you're comfortable with that. Yeah, we've done this before with bullying on Cross Currents, and it worked interestingly well. So, you know, I'm going to pretend to be I'm this kid, you know, I'm whatever, 7 years old, and I walk over to a girl and kind of feel on her hair, for example, and, you know, ooh, you know, Lisa, why is your hair like that? What should be the response? If we are talking about educating children, educating their families, educating the teachers, let's assume this is the well-educated, so racially aware child who is perfect in every way. What should their response be?
I mean, for me, I mean, I'm a little bit hesitant to give prescriptive responses, because I think for me, how somebody responds in a particular incident is a function of a lot of things. The nature of the relationship, what the desired outcome is, one's ability to comprehend what's happening in that moment. But it's an interesting question. I'll just give you an example. I know that my wife is a school principal, and she's African American, and on occasion she'll straighten her hair, because some cases just she'll do that. And I know she is confronted with a slew of comments about how attractive she is, how pretty her hair looks, and this is very different from when she wears her hair in twists. Right. And so we have conversations oftentimes about how do you deal with parents who may say these things. You know, and part of it is recognizing that it may be an honest or authentic response. Maybe they see her as looking more attractive because she looks more like them with her hair straight. But at the end of the day, she's in a community. She heads up a community. And so her ability to be in a leadership, you know, position is a function about how she navigates that conversation. So I think that the response probably has to vary. Now, if it's a child to a child, I might sort of have an offline conversation about how do you think, you know, let me just ask you a question. If somebody came up and was, you know, feeling your hair and saw you as an oddity, and, you know, how might you respond to that, and then sort of recognize that it might come out of curiosity, but there are consequences to those things. I mean, I think for me, I think we've gotten so reactive around race as a society that in some cases we box ourselves in terms of how we respond to things that they're, you know, so we're more interested in having, quote unquote, the right conversation than an authentic conversation.
Hmm.
And I think authenticity is really critical and important. I mean, it reconnects us with our humanity and suggests that some days we may be able to have that great response, and some days, you know, we might not really have it in us. And I think that, you know, everybody deserves the opportunity to be seen as fully human, and sometimes people are going to make mistakes. But I do think this is about relationships, and I think for me, always the long term is what is it, what's required, and what might be most useful in making a relationship viable and sustainable over time. Because I think when we look at these sort of cross-racial friendships, that is the context in which our habits of mind get reconstructed, the way in which we assign meaning to behaviors evolves through having different sort of referential points that we can add to our context of understanding.
Right. Let me give out that number again, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So since this is a show about how, you know, how to show children how to deal with racism, let me take that example and intensify it a little bit. Let's pretend they're a little older. They know what they're talking about. And someone comes up to an African-American boy and, you know, taunts him about looking like a monkey, something as extreme as that. What kind of reactions should the boy have? Mm-hmm. Let me learn from Milton's what Milton just said. Not what reactions should he have, but what do you teach him about a moment like that and how he should respond?
Well, in the first scenario, there was actually something very positive in the notion that one person is actually reaching out and touching the hair of another person.
Right.
I mean, that suggests that there's at least a possibility of some kind of connection. In your second scenario, you're dealing with a person who's aggressive.
Right.
You're dealing with an aggressor. And I think that any parent would want their child, first of all, to have the sense of personal integrity to know that this is an aggressor, know that they need to try to deactivate the situation as much as possible, try to get to a safe place, try to find an authority that can help them. I mean, confrontation is only going to lead to an escalation of the problem. So it's a different situation. I mean, something that's more subversive is what happens when that same young person sees an image or hears a song, a rap song or something, something that's part of their cultural environment that they are supposed to take into their hearts, but contains a negative message just like the one you were suggesting. I mean, that's a more dangerous situation. And I don't think that we as a culture have figured out yet how to filter, I mean, without becoming censors, or how to prepare people, as I was saying earlier, to analyze the way messages coming at us in cultural forms can infiltrate our lives and really contaminate our consciousness.
We've been doing this for such a long... I remember in the 70s, Sesame Street, you know, with all the messages of, you know, racial equity and how to treat people, and this, you know, with the 80s went by and the 90s, and these are the 2000s, and... Where are we then? How do you feel that there's been any progress?
Well, I feel like
we're having the same conversations every decade.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, but there is an evolution of the way we understand how those conversations operate. I mean, there are tiers in our culture, like Sesame Street, for example, or KLW, that try to provide a meta-narrative, a meta-way of understanding how to look at and deconstruct these languages. And we have systems that are trying to project positive symbols to address recognized cultural problems. Mm-hmm. So those things do exist. And so there has been an evolution. There's no question about it. But the problem still remains, you know, that when you have a culture that systematically breaks down families of color, I mean, there's a crisis in the American, African-American family. When you have systems that feed the incarceration system with black bodies, and when you have those kinds of things working on a broad cultural level, then you get a young person who's in the midst of a complex dilemma. And ultimately, as individuals, I mean, all we can as individuals do is try to live healthy, conscious, integral lives and model those lives and behaviors for the young people around us. I mean, that's all we can really do.
So be the example. And don't be talking wrong at home.
But I should also say, you know, that as an artist, we try to take the fundamental phenomenology of change. Like, what does it mean to change? I mean, how do people change? And we try to systemize that in cultural forms. That's what Question Bridge is. Mm-hmm. It really tries to take a person who walks into the presence of Question Bridge with one set of impressions of the way black men live and feel and change those impressions. That's what Question Bridge attempts to do. And the thing that surprised us, so I was saying to Milton earlier, you know, we did this as an art project with no understanding of whether it was going to work or not. And it's been really widely received, and it's been very gratifying.
Okay, Milton, with Facing History, Facing Ourselves, part of it aims to come to terms with horrible atrocities of the past, with, you know, the Holocaust, with slavery. You deal with anti-Semitism as well. Through education, and so I'm wondering what tools do you have to help youth process conflicts around race and racism like that? That's some heavy material in an era where we're trying to shield and protect our children from, you know, images they might see now.
Yeah, I mean, I think speaking very specifically, I mean, I think within our work, we've got a couple tools that are important. One is curriculum and content. And I think to think about history as a politically defined narrative, right? It's historians do their work, but what ends up being required or students end up responding to is actually in many cases, you know, the standards are defined politically. So part of one of the things you can do is you can punctuate larger sort of master narratives with new bits of history that complicate the way in which people think about it. And again, sort of looking at race through the lens of eugenics allows us to reconnect the concept of race to the centrality of national identity and to be able to speak about patterns of resource allocation based on notions about people's innate fitness, right? And so when we can follow these patterns over time, we can look at how institutions, in many cases, racialize people and replicate race. Mm. And I think the other thing we can do, particularly with that history, is to actually reconnect concepts of race that in many cases are fragmented. So when I look at the history of eugenics, it's very clear to see that gender, and particularly the surveillance of women's reproductive labor, is very much connected to conceptions of race. So when you look at issues of immigration or national identity, or you look at education systems that confer a lot, confer or deny opportunities based on a variety of different things, how resources are even allocated within schools, we can see that the systems work. I think the other thing is pedagogical tools. How do we help construct conversations such that people develop the capacity to be in the conversation, but also in ways that shift their conceptual understanding? If we talk about race as people, we will forever be locked in this conversation. I think we have to be able to understand that race is an idea. And when you understand that race is an idea, and a very important one in understanding modern society, you can then begin to look at the way in which these ideas are moved through societies, but also ways in which they're contested. And I think, you know, it's an ongoing process. And so to that extent, it's a conversation I suspect we'll always be in as a nation. But as we change demographically and we move towards becoming a majority-minority nation, I think these conversations about race are going to be increasingly important for us to be in. I think many of the intractable issues that we address as a society are very difficult to solve without the very people who are dealing with these issues at the table, at the solution table. So we have to be able to solve these issues in education where we're hemorrhaging large numbers of kids of color who, quite frankly, will be, you know, leaders in the future. And we need to be able to reinvest and understand that race is not something we do for those people. Race is something, addressing these issues, something we do for ourselves as a society.
All right. And that will have to be your final thought, Chris. The last thing.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, if people want to experience Question Bridge, it actually in the Bay Area is at the Catherine Clark Gallery at 150 Minna Street.
Excellent.
And it's going to be at the Exploratorium for a year.
Thank you. And thank you, Melanie Killen, who also joined us today. And Shakti Butler, thank you for being with us. Thank you for joining with us. Here's what's coming up next time on Your Call. How can art humanize people on the margins? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Rodessa Jones, longtime performer and social activist, about her latest one-woman show, The Resurrection of She. She uses theater to work with female prison inmates and HIV-positive women and dives into the realities of being Black and female today. Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What's the power of theater to tell the stories of those who feel invisible? It's Your Call with me, Hannah Baba, and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.